This is an audio recording for Session 7, Metaphors of Control and Development. It has two main parts. The first is just looking and thinking about development, the science. And the second part, which fits in with the evolving themes of the course, is how we interpret the science in relationship to the scientist's social position. In particular, how we interpret the metaphors that are explicit or implicit in the science. The first part, looking at the science of development, is because most biology students I've found are unfamiliar with development. Or at least if they think about development, it's about genes turning on and off at various times. During gestation and during the adult life, maybe. There's not much attention to morphogenesis, the way a single cell divides, becomes a ball of cells, invaginates, turns inside itself, and that inner layer, the endoderm, and the outer layer, the ectoderm, interact to create an in-between layer, the mesoderm, out of which many of our organs, our blood vessels, arise, and how that then goes on to form, you know, the ball becomes something which has a bilateral structure with a nervous cord and a spinal cord and so on. So I used to show films to remind people of that amazing process of morphogenesis, of forming, of generating form. I won't do that in this case, but I do want to get you to think about how a simple structure, the initial cell, initial fertilized egg, can become a complex and differentiated structure. And how difficult it is for us to explain that. The very word development, like evolution, has its origins in an idea that what's happening is an unfolding of something that's already there, rather than a formation of something more complicated from something that is simpler. There's a preparatory activity that introduces the challenge of thinking about development, which also feeds into the second part of the session about metaphors. And I'll get to that shortly. There's also three class activities. The second part builds upon this preparatory activity. The first part, we're really going to play around with a simulation to get us to think about this process of complexity coming from simplicity and other themes about how development occurs. In the last part of the session, we'll be looking at the pros and cons of Scott Gilbert's interpretation of two competing ideas of development a century ago from a biologist, Just, and another biologist, Goldschmidt. He's interpreting the metaphors that run through both these people's work, which was quite different. The same Scott Gilbert is actually, his profession is a developmental biologist, and you may even have seen his textbook, which is going into the nth edition now, called Development or Developmental Biology. But before I talk about the preparatory activity, let me consider a question. We know that Darwin wrote the first edition of On the Origin of Species in 1859, and we know that Gregor Mendel developed his principles of inheritance at almost the same time. We know that Darwin read incredibly widely, had correspondents from all over the world, and yet he never mentions Mendel. We know that Darwin was concerned with the mechanisms of heredity, and also the mechanisms that generated the variability that his theory of natural selection depended upon to work. So why did Darwin not come across Mendel? Think about this for a moment. Think about, if you've been given any explanations, what they were. And if you haven't, what might be your explanation? Well, the classic explanation I was given was that Mendel did his work as a monk in the monks in the garden of a monastery somewhere in a remote part of Central Europe. But unfortunately, this doesn't really pan out. Mendel was sponsored by a more senior member of the church who was very involved in selective breeding. And the area that that Mendel and his boss, if you should call it, worked in was Moravia, which was a center of selective breeding, particularly of sheep for better quality wool at that time. So they're very much involved in practical matters of the world, not isolated, just playing with peas in his garden. A possible answer, I can't assure you that this is right, is that Darwin would not have seen what Mendel was doing as heredity. It was something specialized. Heredity at that time had multiple meanings, and it continued to have multiple meanings well into the 20th century. It was only in the 20s and the 30s that genetics pushes its way to ascendancy and is now almost synonymous with the term heredity. The additional reading, the follow-up reading by Jan Sapp, gives a sense of those multiple meanings. And because you won't necessarily read that reading in advance, I'll just give you a little idea of Jan Sapp's article and the multiple meanings of heredity. Well, even before we go to Jan Sapp's article, if we think about it, we know about inheritance, we know about wills. And what happens with a will is that the assets of the elderly adult get passed on to the offspring who are already, often they're already adults themselves. Often they even have children themselves. It's not something that gets passed on in a little egg that then has to be made again into the net inheritance. So our colloquial idea of inheritance, about something being transmitted adult to adult, still persists. We still call that, you know, one's inheritance. So certainly in the 19th century, people confused the idea that inheritance might be transmission of characters we would now call acquired characteristics from those that had to be regenerated or developed every generation. In fact, by the 6th edition of On the Origin of Species, Darwin was definitely giving more room for the transmission of acquired, what we would call the transmission of acquired characteristics, than he was in the first edition. Okay, Jan Sapp. He says in the beginning of the article, the question normally posed, how did the Mendelian theory of heredity come to be generally accepted? I'm going to replace by the question, how did genetics based on the Mendelian notion of heredity, come to be the dominant discipline in the field of heredity? What would be the alternatives? Well, development was perhaps the strongest field in which heredity was studied. In a way, it kind of makes sense. If you want to have traits and compare the traits of offspring and parents, you have to be able to develop that traits. It's not interesting to have eye color if you don't have eyes. So how do eyes develop? And upon that, how do eyes then get to have color? But we also look at cytology, what's going on in cells, how cells divide. We're looking at embryology, of course, how that single cell becomes a ball of cells and so on. We're looking at practical breeding. All the other stuff might be quite theoretical if it can't help the breeding of plants and animals. We're looking at natural history, how we have the diversity of forms and how the diversity of forms that are at one point of time compare with the diversity of forms later. We're also looking at what became to be called biometry, and which is collecting, if we see a bell curve of people's heights, we're getting into the field of biometry. It's a quantitative measurements of some characteristic, and we could compare that curve from one generation to the next, and so on. These were all, and there are other areas, legitimate areas of the study of heredity. So genetics in the early 20th century was a newcomer, and it's an interesting history that Jan Sapp describes as to how it became the dominant view. And the resistance to what it showed and what it didn't show. So that is the background to this session, Metaphors of Control and Development. The exercise that I want you to do in preparation is the one where described in the on the link that you get to, if you on the syllabus, there's always for every session a link that says details, and it describes the overall themes for the session, and then it mentions the mini lecture, and the second link is an activity that I want you to try out in advance. And then we'll discuss your attempts in class. But in brief, you have to explain inheritance to aliens who don't have development. They're just always the way they've been. And it turns out it's quite difficult to do, quite challenging, quite interesting. Of course, we're very used to the idea that genes determine everything. We get the genes passed on from our parents, and then they control everything that's going on. But the aliens are going to ask you to explain how that can happen, if that's the language you choose to use. You'll find that there are alternative pictures of that and alternative metaphors, and you might develop some of them of your own. Let me just finish the discussion by talking a little bit about metaphor. We've been introduced to metaphor in the context of one of the layers of argument in the early chapters of On the Origin of Species, but we didn't delve into what metaphor is about. Some of you in English class may have got strict definitions of metaphor versus simile and so on. But here we're just thinking of a broad brush idea that we've got, well, we've got two ideas, A and B. A is the one we're interested in, and B is the one we know better, and we have associations of B. So when we say A is like B, we're going to treat A as if it's B. Then all the associations of B are going to stir up our thinking about A. So when Darwin wanted us to think about the change in diversity of forms from one generation to the next, he wanted us to think about it as if nature were selecting, as if nature were some agent that could choose the favorable and reject the injurious. He knew there was no agent of nature. There was no place, but we were going to think about it as if. That term as if is, for me, key to metaphor. So when you have the associations of selection, they were quite strong for his readers at that time because selective breeding and plants and animals, plant improvement, animal improvement, was going very well in that early to middle part, in that middle period of the 19th century. It had become something that was working quite well for the first time, rather than unsystematic and a bit haphazard. And so we could see, well, particularly when he gave us the extended chapter one with all these examples from domestic selection, we could see the idea that you could get improvement of how well something was adapted to its circumstances through selection that was almost unconscious over a long period of time. And that's interesting because selection, you know, when you get selected to get into college, it's like at a one point of time, you're in or you're not. So that association Darwin didn't want. He wanted associations that were more about the slow and steady incremental, tiny increments adding up over a long period of time. So the metaphor worked fairly well, but it had associations which weren't so helpful. And that tends to be the case when we use metaphors for all sorts of things, but for development in particular. So try out the activity explaining heredity to aliens. Do the readings that are in the preparatory section of those details, and let's see what comes out when we look at both development and then interpretations of the metaphors of development and heredity that people are using a century ago.